Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays 1 to 2 p.m. on CliffCentral.com.
Good afternoon. You're with us on the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. Back after a long weekend. Greg, how are you doing after the nice three-day weekend?
I was very busy. I went to the EFF rally. There were a number of other issues on, so it wasn't quite a weekend.
But not much of a weekend. And here we are, back this Tuesday, start of the week, back for a short week. I hope you're all doing okay. Remember, you can tweet us at DMShowZA. And I think Greg has also set up the Instagram account, so if you want to engage with us over there.
That's on Daily Maverick, so you can check it out there.
Absolutely. We are very, you know, technologically focused. We're like the aunt who's on social media 5 years too late and asking if you got her poke. Anyway, time to jump into this week's show. In preparing this, we've been doing a lot of thinking and reflection and reading just about colonialism and just the devastating effect that it had on the African continent. I'm thinking back to redrawn boundaries, displaced people, and just absolutely no regard for people's history and culture and basic human life. Thinking back to the separated families, separated culture, the lost history, you know, burned and destroyed civilizations that we, you know, may never get back. And when we think back on this, it's often based on this idea that colonialism in that original form, sort of rape and pillage form, is over. So it's really, really crazy when we hear that some people since the 50s and 60s, when a lot of this, actually through to the 70s, when a lot of this was ending its original form and a lot of countries were receiving their independence, you know, so your Ghanas, your Kenyas, and so on, were getting independence. Some people just never got that. And we're hearing that as recently as 2016, people have never been able to return home, to go back to their land, to claim their right to their place and their land and the place where their descendants before them sort of lived and existed. So we'll talk a bit more about this. On the line, we have the president in exile, Alan Venkatesan. Can you hear me, Alan?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. Now, Alan, I'd just love to talk about where you're originally from. Where is your family originally from?
Yes, I was born in Diego Garcia, which is in the British Indian Ocean Territory, on a world map that would be opposite Africa and near the Seychelles. My family also, they were born there, born and bred.
Alan, you don't live there now. What happened? Why is your family no longer living there?
When I was only 1 year old, all of us, so the people of the Chagos Islands, that includes the main island, Diego Garcia, Peros Banos, and Solomon Island, we were exiled by the UK government to make way for a US military base. And this happened between 1965 and 1973.
Alan, what did that removal process actually look like? Was there some kind of notice period? Was it, you know, what did the actual removal of people who were living and inhabiting those islands, what did that look like?
There was no notice at all. It's only one morning, the manager of the plantation there on Diego Garcia, he told my father that the island is now closed and that all of you will have to go.
And I mean, where were people moved to? Where did, I mean, this is, you know, thousands of people. Where did people move to?
There was about 1,200 of us, and we were shipped to the island of Mauritius, then became independent in 1968. And also we were sent to the Seychelles, which was close to Diego Garcia. So sent on ship like animals with no provision at all. When we reach the capital of Mauritius in Port Louis, and we were just dumped on the wharf there, and we stayed there several weeks in the open air without no housing, no health, and no food provision at all. And we have to find our own way in that city, begging for food, asking for food, and try to get helps from people.
Alan, can you tell us what was that like?
That was a culture shock for us. It was like hell, really, because we were so peaceful. We were like in paradise in our homeland. And when we reach a country where we've never been before, or even if some of us were happened to be there on holiday before, it was chaotic with the fact that it's a new kind of life and there was no provision waiting for us. So at least if you are trying to dump some people, you know, onto a remote island, at least you need to be able to give them the proper housing and proper care that they need on day one. So there was no such thing at all. And it was done in the most callous way and the most secret way. No one knew about it.
And at that stage, do you remember how your parents felt, how they were trying to survive, and how did they feel about this exile and eviction?
My grandfather tried to resist it on the island itself, but people were so fearful, so afraid that gas bombs were going to be exploded there. They were so afraid seeing their pets, their dogs were killed in front of them. So they thought that they might, in a certain way, have the same fate as their pets. And they preferred to embark on the ship to Mauritius. And life was so tough in Mauritius, and they had to go about and try to get jobs, you know, to fend for their families, and also trying to make a living in a place, in a country where they were considered as second class citizens, and it was very, very hard.
I mean, Alan, just as you talk about families, was there any effort to try and keep, you know, either maybe perhaps different tribes or different family units together to make sure that when they were moved on, they were moved to the same sort of relocation place?
In many cases, this was not done properly. I get you my own example. My mom was sent to the Seychelles and my dad was sent to Mauritius. And I ended up being raised by my grandparents. And I recently came to know about somebody, a lady who met his other sisters in the UK and never met them since they were deported. So this shows, you know, how this was not a plan in a human way. And we were kind of, you know, people that were expendables, really.
So your family was completely torn apart by this exile, separation, and eviction?
Definitely. I came to meet my mother when I was 17 years old. So after 17 years, then only I met my mom in the Seychelles, you know. And there was no love there. I couldn't figure out things. And she was like stranger to me, you know, and because we've never bonded, I didn't get the opportunity to live as any other children did. And certainly our rights as children at that time was not respected at all.
I mean, Alan, you're describing your personal story and you mentioned another person you know this happened to, but this wasn't unique. How many people would you say were experienced this, or how many people were originally on the Chagos Islands when this happened?
Yeah, I believe there are hundreds of cases this way. And also, you know, there were about 1,200 of us who were evicted from our homeland, from all these islands together with Diego Garcia. So, you know, when you talk about hundreds of people being separated from families, you then get a community, you know, families that are broken and which are very difficult to mend in a certain way, that for them to progress and to go into life as normal as other people. So it's grave what happened to us.
Alan, if you could just tell us, you know, a bit about what happened next. I mean, you've described people being moved to the Seychelles, to Mauritius, to other islands. If you could just trace some of the general movements in general of where people have ended up, where they are now, the descendants and some of the perhaps surviving members of the people who were forcibly removed from your home.
Yes, so we were in Mauritius for lots of years, and only when there was a change in the law of the overseas territories of the UK concerning the right of abode of British subjects that were in the overseas territories, then we were allowed under a new law, the British Overseas Territories Act 2002. To have a right of abode in the UK, because in history, you know, there were different classes of British citizenship at that time, and these kind of citizenship, you know, with these kinds of citizenship, we did not have any right of abode in the UK. So we were removed from our homeland, which was a British dependent territories country at that time. Sent into an independent country of Mauritius, but we were barred from coming to the UK because our class of citizenship at that time precluded us. So in the change in 2002, when the change happened, I decided to embark on an adventure to come to the UK with my people for a new life, because we were in abject poverty in Mauritius. Life was very, very blur, very dark, and we suffered lots of kinds of prejudice, you know. And so I decided, you know, with the help of God, by faith, I did take 19 people, and we came over to the UK and to start a new life. And then I organized several groups of 50 and 120. So this happened in a period of starting from 2002 to 2004. And we embarked and came to Mauritius and started a new life, bring our family over, and getting jobs. And now we've got about 3,000 of us here in the UK. We live near Gatwick in a place known as Crawley, and Crawley has been our town these past 13 years.
Now, Alan, you talked about the difficulties you face living in Mauritius. When you were forced, or when Chagossians were forced out of their homeland, were they offered any sort of compensation or assistance at resettlement?
My grandfather sued the British government in 1975.
Really?
And in 1982, a conservative government in the UK decided to solve the matter and asked my grandfather to remove his case before the High Court in London so that they can pay a compensation to the people. And my grandfather was very reluctant to remove the case, but because of pressure and the abject poverty that people they were in, my grandfather finally had no other alternative than to remove the case. Then the United Kingdom of Great Britain paid £3 million sterling with signatories to accept this sum of money as a full and final settlement of all claim, past, present, and future. And we got about £1,000 sterling in today's value, which is like peanuts. And people at that time didn't realize that this money was not enough, despite my grandfather explained it to them. But I could understand, certainly, because people were so poor, they were so indebted. Many people didn't even have food, you know, to put on their table. It was very, very hard. And and people had to sign these signatories form before they can get their compensation. And the deal was done. And there is no other compensation paid afterward. And that's why I made a decision to come to the UK to start a new life and to work here and to raise the standard of living of my people. That was the only alternative that I had. And I'm glad I took that decision.
But the issue is far from over.
It is far from over. That's true. And a couple couple of years ago, I negotiated a pilot resettlement with the conservative government, the new government that came into power here in the UK. And the then minister, Mr. Mark Simmons, agreed to do a feasibility study because I wanted my people to be able to return to their homeland. Even to Diego Garcia, where there is a military base, because around the globe there are other U.S. bases where a civilian population is living and working on the base. So I see no reason why, in our case, this can be denied. So the government agreed. So a feasibility study was done by the firm KPMG, which is internationally well known, and they came up with a report saying that there should be and there is no barrier to resettlement, no legal and no practical barrier to resettlement in our homeland. So now we await for a governmental decision to be taken by the Prime Minister and his cabinet, really. And we are still waiting. It's taking us some time, and perhaps the in and out EU referendum is causing a delay in our case, in our process. But we are hopeful.
I mean, Alan, I really commend you for still being hopeful despite, you know, everything going on. I'm very curious. I mean, you speak very passionately about the people you came over with, and you describe, you know, my people, as you speak about your, you know, leadership role. And I'm curious what the general feelings are of the people you represent. Is there anger towards the UK? Is there hatred? Is there resentment? Or what would you describe as sort of the emotional general feeling of the people you represent?
I think there is quite a bitterness there, and because you know, one can empathize that in so many years living in exile, and certainly for the suffering and all the consequences of exile, you know, which continues in the life of people, and these kinds of hurts, they are in your soul, and they can't go in one day or in years, and in some cases may never be able to be removed from these people's heart. I would say anger is there, but at the same time, as for me and I believe many other people in my community, we have forgiven this act of barbarism against us, against our people. And I think forgiveness has got the power, really, to allow things to change. And with good diplomacy and good continue, we need to continue to talk, you know, open the talk with the UK government and leave that line of talks, of communication open always, you know, and working together for this to become a reality. The world has changed, and it is continuing to change. So I believe in my community there are people who are still angry about it, but there are people also who have forgiven the country for this wrong that was done. And I think our success will be through forgiveness and cooperation and partnership working. These are keys, and I think that's the way forward.
Alan, I'm so sorry for what has happened to you and you know, to all the people, you know, that you represent. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us, and, you know, we really wish you the best of luck on your process to finally returning home.
Thank you very much.
Fantastic. That was us talking to President in Exile of the Chagosian Islands, Alan Venkatesan, who was just describing, you know, his sort of leadership role in trying to navigate the complicated emotional journey, political journey, sort of legislative hurdles that still stand in between, you know, thousands of people and them finally returning home. Greg, we were talking a bit before the show, and we're just thinking how crazy it was that during the sort of Cold War era that deals like this were being struck.
No, I think so. We haven't quite got into what exactly happened yet, and essentially what happened was that the Chagos Islands were British territories, and in, I think it was in 1966, yeah, the deal was struck between when the United States wanted to have a military base established on Diego Garcia, which is one of the biggest islands in the region. Mm. And we have to remember at the time it was going through the Cold War, where both the Soviet Union and the US were fighting for supremacy in different regions, yeah, sort of around the world. And so Great Britain entered into a deal with the US where essentially they allowed the United States to establish a military base on Diego Garcia for the paltry amount of $1 a year, at least for $1 a year. And in return, the Brits got a huge discount on nuclear technology. I think it was about $14 million discount to establish some of their own sort of nuclear technology in the UK. And at the time, and since documents have been released, going back to how sort of the locals, the Chagossians were described in that era, you could see that the sort of these Western superpowers had absolutely no regard for their humanity or their rights. I think they called them Tarzans, they called them Man Fridays. And then essentially what happened was there was a, I think like we heard from Alan just now, there was this sort of process of eviction, and it happened over a number of years. Some people were sort of forcefully removed, but many were sort of, I don't know how you'd say it. I guess through stages.
I know for some people they would sort of let you leave thinking you were leaving voluntarily, mm-hmm, on holiday or for business.
Perhaps you go to Mauritius for health concerns.
Yeah, which wasn't the strangest thing in the world, but they just wouldn't let you back in.
That's right. You try to get back home and they say no.
Okay.
So you have to go back to Mauritius. For some other people, I think like Alan mentioned, he mentioned a plantation. I think there was quite a large coconut plantation on one of the islands. Mm-hmm. And what the British did is while they were sort of going through this process of staged evictions, is the British bought the largest coconut plantation and then they closed it down. And so sort of people lost their jobs and also sort of an income and food supply was cut off. There's stories of other sort of food shortages and different other ways that locals were sort of forced out of their homeland and essentially sent into exiles, most often in the Seychelles or Mauritius. And since the US still has that military base on Diego Garcia, and until this year, and this is, I think we should mention, one of the key reasons that we're talking about this issue today, is that it's 50 years, their deal is up. And so one of the questions is now, what's Britain going to do with this land that it still owns, it still has, unlike many, many other places that we know in Africa and around the world where nations have been able to win their independence, Britain still is in charge of the Chagos Islands.
Yeah, I mean, talking a bit about this before, it was just interesting talking to, you know, as we did our research, talking to some of the support organizations that are out there in the UK, and these are sort of just regular British people who've heard about the cause and through different ways have stumbled into it and are really trying to take up the cause of the Chagossians who have limited influence in the UK. You know, when you're foreign, you're a small group, you're a minority, your influence can be quite limited politically and, you know, socioeconomically. So it's been really encouraging to see a small group of people who've come together, like the Chagos Support Organization in the UK, and you know, you've chatted with them over the past week, and seeing them take up that cause and trying to capitalize around this opportunity that you said comes up this year, the deal that was struck in 1966 comes up, like you mentioned, December of this year. So it's quite a unique opportunity to really ramp up the political pressure, and hopefully there can be for some justice for the Chagossians this year.
And there has been sort of increased pressure on this issue. So I think maybe about a decade ago, hardly anybody knew about what was going on in this sort of travesty. But there's been a number of things happening, particularly in the UK, sort of within Parliament and politics, as well as within the courts, and some of these groups, as you mentioned, rallying around the Chagossians, and both from the community and people supporting them, who are really trying to, number one, put this issue on the public agenda. Number two, challenging Parliament to do the right thing, and essentially they want to be returned and allowed access back to their homeland with sort of compensation and assistance to start up new lives there. And number three, through the courts. There's sort of a simultaneous process of all three going on that has made it possible, particularly this year, and there's I think quite an optimism that after 50 years something might change. for the sort of an optimism for one of Britain's most brutal acts of the 20th century, for the country, for the UK to atone for what they've done, even if that will never address the pain and hardship that someone like Alan has gone through.
I can't put it any better than that. I mean, it's quite interesting, because not interesting, but frustrating, because there's two sides. One is a very personal and emotional journey. And really, it's unthinkable that this is happening in 2016. And the second half is really something that's so hard and cold. It's a political process. It's a legislative process. And like all, you know, inquiries, and we know all about this in South Africa, is when the second you have commissions of inquiry and feasibility studies and sort of that endless political and judicial process, I mean, it takes forever. And the second is an election cycle. And elections, it's either, you know, it gets pushed off and said, oh, we'll deal with this after elections. And if the government changes, and if you switch from a Labour government to a Conservative government, they have a different stance on this. So it's quite, you know, depressing to have people asking for, you know, basic justice, and to be heard and to be, you know, compensated for what they've been through. And you're kind of being told, you know, just hang on for a bit. I know you spoke with somebody who's in the process, who's part of the parliamentary group, and, you know, we'll be able to play that interview pretty soon. Is there any more context you think we need to give before we sort of jump into that?
I think it's just important to remember, like I said, that there are different people working on this issue and there's different processes happening right now. But I think as the interview will show, it's a long process. And it's not going to be easy.
Okay. So we're just about to play an interview that we sort of recorded with David Snoxall, who is the chair of the all-party parliamentary group, who's part of the sort of complicated web of legislative and parliamentary procedures that we mentioned that's going on right now.
Just to start, can you tell me, when you were High Commissioner, how did you get involved and how did you first learn about the issues of in the Chagos Islands, and how did it sort of play out during your tenure?
Yes. Well, I was, before I became High Commissioner to Mauritius, in the mid-90s, when I was Deputy Head of Southern African Department in the Foreign Office, I was also the Deputy Commissioner to the British Indian Ocean Territory. So that's in the mid-90s. And I got familiar with some of the issues then. Though I hasten to add, I was only very, very dimly aware of what had happened to the Chagosians. It was really going to the courts, all that litigation, which brought it out into the full public view. And then I was ambassador in West Africa, and my last posting was High Commissioner to Mauritius. Now, obviously, Mauritius, where the Chagosians were exiled to, or the large majority of them were sent to, was hugely involved with Chagos, not least because they claimed to have sovereignty over the islands, which is the case, in fact. But so I used to meet the Chagosian leaders, and shortly after I arrived there in November 2000, the High Court gave its judgment and restored the right of return to the Chagosians for the Outer Islands, not to Diego Garcia, since it was a military base. It was me that conveyed that to the Chagosians at the time, and I had many meetings with them over the course of the next 4 years. It was clearly a fractious relationship at times, simply because I was representing the UK, not my own personal views, which some times can be different from the views of the government, which the Chagosians saw me then as possibly, well, the enemy. I would be going a bit too strong, but anyway, not on their side. In point of fact, I was very much on their side. I very much agreed that they should be allowed to return to their homeland. Shall I carry on? Yes, all right. Well, now,
No. So on that, you've written quite a bit on this, and it seems to be quite a personal issue for you. Why do you seem to care about this issue so much? What makes you passionate about
because
it?
Because this is one of the most egregious breaches of fundamental human rights that Britain has committed in the 20th century. And my background is human rights. I did 5 years of human rights in Geneva, and I believe very strongly that Britain should put this right. And this was a relic of the Cold War, and that there was no real reason why they shouldn't, or those that wanted to resettle, be allowed to go back. So I'm going to fight that until we win. And I think we've made a vast amount of progress, which we can come on to. But I'm very much committed to the Chagossian cause, both personally and intellectually.
Now, you're the chairperson on the all-party parliamentary group. Can you tell us, working on this issue, can you tell us a little bit about what that group does and who's involved?
Yes. I'm not the chairman. The chairman always has to be a politician. The chairman is Andrew Rossendale, a Conservative MP. Before that, it was Jeremy Corbyn for the previous 7 years. And I sat with Jeremy through 50-odd meetings. We now have 54. So I am the coordinator of the group, and it's in a voluntary capacity. It's my job, really, to bring the whole thing together and to give the groups a sense of direction. Politicians know what they want to do. They know where they want to get to, but very often they don't know how to get there, especially when you're dealing with the British government and the bureaucracy. Now, the group itself is a surprisingly strong and high-profile group. As I said, we've had 54 meetings already in 7 years. And it's made up of all the political parties in Parliament. This is, so far as I know, this is the only, what we call them, APPG, all-party parliamentary group, that has complete representation across the political spectrum from far left to far right. And we've got some quite notable politicians on there. Of course, they can't be in government at the time, but we've had up to four former foreign ministers in the FCO. We've still got three of them who are members, and that itself sends a signal. Those three actually dealt with Chagos issues one during my time, and they clearly feel strongly that what has happened in the past has been wrong and Britain should put it right, and that it sullies Britain's reputation for the promotion of human rights. It's hypocrisy, really, that we should allow this to continue in our own backyard. Two British citizens, Chagossians are British citizens, and yet be preaching to the world about what they should be doing on human rights. And I think that's something that the members of the group, whatever party they belong to, wherever they are on the political spectrum, agree about and feel. For now, the purpose of the group is clearly stated. It is to help bring about a resolution of the issues concerning the future of the Chagos Islanders and of the Chagos Islands. The future of the Chagos Islands is very much wrapped up with the sovereignty dispute with Mauritius. But perhaps we won't come on to that unless you're interested in it.
Well, tell me, what has this group achieved? So over, you said, 7 years, 54 meetings with some very high-profile members. What has this group achieved?
I think it's hugely raised the awareness of the issues in Parliament and in the public and in the media. And we won't know what it's achieved until we've achieved the end. And then I will be able to say that it had made a huge contribution. The end result is to allow the Chagossians to return to their homeland. And that objective is worked towards by other groups in society, other parliamentarians, and so on. I think the group has already made, however, a huge contribution towards moving this forward. When the group was founded in 2008, 1908, there was complete ignorance about the Chagos Islands, it seemed, pretty much across the board. There were a few parliamentarians who understood it. Jeremy Corbyn was the one who knew it most, and he was elected chairman. And but little by little, the group have been able to show that the arguments advanced by the bureaucracy, I mean the Foreign Office, such as defence and intelligence and security, conservation, and treaty obligations to the United States, maritime law, and so on, were all unfounded arguments. These are arguments that officials clutch to. They've inherited them. In my time doing this job, I have seen 12 different ministers dealing with the issue. So ministers and officials come and go, and they inherit the arguments of their predecessors, and they deploy them without any real understanding of whether those arguments are still legitimate and still relevant. I think where we've got to is to show that all the arguments, including feasibility, it is feasible. We were always told it was not feasible because of an earlier study that has since been discredited. It has shown that these arguments no longer apply. There are really no arguments left as to why the British government should not now restore the right of return and begin to facilitate a resettlement. Now, this has been great. It helped in the last few days because President Obama was here, and the Prime Minister raised it with Obama. This was the first time that a British Prime Minister and the US President had actually discussed together the resettlement of the Chagosians and the future of Bayat. This is all linked to the agreement that the UK and US have over the islands, which was agreed in 1966, which comes up for renewal at the end of this year for a further 20 years. Now, it's all linked in. What the parliamentary group is saying is that the Americans are partly responsible for what happened, not exclusively, and therefore, for the agreement to be renewed, a condition should be that they should help to pay for it and help to facilitate a resettlement. Now, the reaction, I should say that President Obama then later met Jeremy Corbyn. Jeremy Corbyn, leader of the Labour Party, also the honorary president of our group, raised the issues with Obama, and all I know is that Obama listened sympathetically and raised no objections. Now, if he raised no objections, it means that there really are no solid objections or difficulties on the part of the US. But over the last 15 years, if you'd listened to the Foreign Office, you would have been told many times that the Americans oppose resettlement. I've always said I don't think that's the case, I don't think it's true, and now I think this meeting at the highest level, this is the furthest we've ever got with it, demonstrates clearly that there are no real difficulties with resettlement. Cost is certainly one. It's the one being deployed most at the moment, but it's not that expensive, and there aren't going to be that many Chagosians who want to return. Many simply want the right to return restored so that they can visit when they want to visit their homeland. And I think that's the common denominator of all Chagosian groups, wherever they are in the world. But the ones who are likely to want to return are those who live in Mauritius. So Mauritius is very much part of the way forward. Yes, any questions? yes. Well, now I think then we ought to go on to what holds in the future. We are very close to the denouement. I would expect decision by the government on before the summer recess, possibly even before the end of June. I also expect a decision by the Supreme Court on the parallel litigation that is going on by the end of June. Now, I think looking at the government's position at the moment, there will be an offer of some kind of deal or compromise with the Shigozis. Naturally, Parliament wants full resettlement to be restored. It may be something less that the British government offer. It may be full resettlement. Now, if it's something less, for example, it could be visits to the islands, assistance where they live in Mauritius and Seychelles and the UK and so on, of a monetary kind, or even compensation, this will not bring this campaign to an end. The Shigozians are absolutely determined that those who want to return should be allowed to do so. So it will go on, the campaign, and the British government know full well. So I'm inclined to think they're going to move more towards agreeing to a pilot resettlement on Diego Garcia, where the base is. The Americans have made it clear that they don't have a security problem, or rather, if they do, they can deal with it. After all, peoples around the world live close, cheek by jowl, to American bases, so it's not a new problem. So I think that's where that may come out. I may be wrong. I've been wrong in the past. Now, on the Supreme Court decision, the litigation has been going since 1998. So that's getting on for 18 years of litigation. And the Shigozians won in the High Court, and they won in the Appeal Court. They lost in the House of Lords, which was the predecessor of the Supreme Court, in 2008, by a simple 3-2 majority verdict. And they have got it back, or their lawyers have got it back, to the Supreme Court, who are reviewing the House of Lords judgment. And I would have thought that they are more likely to give a favourable judgment for the Shigozians than an unfavourable one, because we are now able to show that the judgment of the Lords in 2008 was based on a discredited feasibility study, which concluded resettlement was not feasible. Now, since then, in 2014, the government decided to have a new feasibility study, and that by KPMG. And KPMG concluded that there were no insuperable obstacles to resettlement, and certainly no legal ones. So I would have thought the Supreme Court would be cognizant of that and aware of that as well. However, you know, as with all judgments, the court is tied down by what it's allowed to review, and it's simply reviewing whether the orders in council of 2004, which stopped the Shigozians returning, are lawful or not. That's really the crux of it. I'm hopeful anyway.
It seems, however, David, that there at the moment are many good reasons, or almost only good reasons, to allow the Shigozians to return to their homeland. But what politically seems to be making this so slow? What is holding this up?
What is holding it up at the moment is a Supreme Court judgment, which we're awaiting, and the decision by the government on the KPMG report. These things are bound to be slow, because the government have held its face against resettlement for so very long, and officialdom. Officialdom is behind it all. But I'm strongly of the view that officials today do now believe that resettlement should be allowed. There's been a lot of deception over the years by government as to the real nature of the issues, and they've been castigated by the courts for that, and that has gone on. And then you had the marine protected area declared by David Miliband in 2010, which was a further obstacle. Obstacles have been raised, and there's a certain degree of officialdom protecting itself here, and not because as soon as it becomes clear that they do now agree that resettlement is correct and right, then it brings into question what is really 15 years of opposition to resettlement and as to why and the motivation. I've hinted at one of the motivations, and that is simply the revolving door. Officials come and go, ministers come and go, so they just pick up the brief where the last officials left off and they maintain it without questioning. And I don't think that's Machiavellian, that's just the nature of civil services, and it probably happens all around the world. But I'll be the first one to agree this has been an inordinately long time, and it has led to the fact that the Chagossians now have been in exile for longer than the biblical Babylonian exile, which is an incredible thought. Yes, well, after it's all over, I may be willing to go into why this took so long in further writings.
David, thank you very much for speaking to us today, and we hope to speak to you once it is all over, which hopefully is soon.
When it comes to foreign investment, what is and what isn't allowed? What happens to your overseas money when you die? With the changes regarding overseas funds and how SARS treats you if you're a South African taxpayer, St. James Global has the answers for you. They've been doing this for years and focus on preserving and protecting offshore wealth, as well as creating succession planning structures. Make sure your worldwide assets pass on into the future. Go to stjamesglobal.com for more information. That's stjamesglobal.com. Your independent wealth managers.
St. James Global is an authorized financial services provider.
Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays 1 to 2 p.m. on cliffcentral.com.
You're back with us on the Daily Maverick Show as we talk about the plight of the Chagossian people, forced from their homes and have been living in exile. Next, we speak to Chair of the UK Chago Support Organization, Stefan Donnelly. Stefan, how are you? Hello, Stefan, can you hear us?
Hello, hi.
Okay, perfect. Stefan, we spent the past sort of 40 minutes or so talking about the plight of the Chagossian people since their forced removal and hearing about the constant sort of legislative and political sort of challenges that have stood in the way of them being able to return home and have some sense of justice. Now, just thinking back from now all the way back to the 1960s, working on this for so long, doesn't this drive you crazy, this issue?
Sorry, could you repeat the question?
I was just curious about your sort of personal feelings about just how long it's taken for these people to get some sense of justice and some form of compensation for how much has been taken from them. And what are your personal feelings on this matter?
I think, like most people, not Chagossian in the UK myself, I just think it's disgraceful, really, that this was done to them in very simple terms. They were forcibly removed from the land they were born in, the land the parents were born in, and many generations before that in a lot of cases. And that's not something you expect to happen in the 20th century, certainly not something you expect your own government to do, which is what happened to Chagossians. And there have been many opportunities over the years to allow them to return or to offer other forms of justice in terms of compensation, as you say, and all of those really have been missed. There's been high court verdicts which have suggested that they should be allowed to go back. There's been resettlement studies that says they can go back. There's no reason why the UK, the US, or the governments involved shouldn't start a resettlement program now. There's still massive demand for it within the community. And my own personal view is just it's a disgrace and a stain on the nation I'm from's reputation that this hasn't been resolved so far. As you said, it's half a century now.
And Stefan, we've heard that the decision to, whether to continue the lease between the UK and the US on the Chagos Islands comes up at the end of this year. what are the key sort of decisions that you're looking to between now and that period that you think will really be the sort of the decisive elements of how this turns out?
Yeah. From our point of view, the key thing is that if that agreement is extended, it should be on the condition that there is mutual US-UK support for discussing returns to the island. Whether that is in terms of finance, actually helping to restart a settlement there, restart society there, or whether it is US agreement on return to Gossians, using some of the military bases facilities, very practical things like Wi-Fi and some of the infrastructure there. So I think those are some of the practical decisions that need to be made. But the fundamental principle, I think, has to be that if this agreement is to be extended, and remember the original agreement is what led to their expulsion, if this is to be extended, it should be conditional on Chagossians, you know, largely UK citizens, being allowed to return to the land they were born in, and the land their families were born in.
And Stefan, just finally, for all of us listening and following the issue around the world, what message would you like to leave us with about all this?
The message for everyone around the world or your listeners is just to try and do what you can to stand up for the Chagossian people. It's a small group of people, and they've been very brave, very resilient in campaigning for this over the years, but it's a small group of people that needs international support. It's an international issue. It involves the UK, it involves the US, it involves Mauritius, Seychelles, countries where they live now. So we need people around the world saying that we won't stand for their continued exile, and we'll do anything we can to back them. And you can find out more information about it on our website, which is chagossupport.org.uk, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, and we'll try and keep you up to date about what's going on in the campaign over the next couple of months, which will be absolutely vital in what happens in the next year or so.
Stefan, thank you so much for talking to us, and please keep up the excellent work.
Thank you very much. Okay. Bye.
There you have it. A big, big decision at the end of the year that could hopefully result in some kind of justice and compensation for people who, you know, still haven't had the freedom and the basic freedoms that the rest of us are enjoying today, which is quite potent, I suppose, for us in South Africa just after Freedom Day. As you've heard, there's a sort of call to action via the Chagos support organization. So please, if you can, you know, go over to there, follow them on Twitter and see if there's any way you can be a part of that. And I'd love if there was a way we could have this higher on our, you know, agenda and on the global agenda to have some kind of justice for this. A big thank you for everyone who spoke to us, and an important shout out to Simon Allison, who sort of started us down this rabbit hole of trying to figure out what was going on, and excellent researching and making connections from my co-host Greg Nicholson for making all this happen. Thank you so much for chatting to us this afternoon. Please share the podcast far and wide, and please do what you can in your sphere of influence to see if there's some way we can help these people. Thanks for tuning in. See you next week, same time, same place.
Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays 1 to 2 p.m. on cliffcentral.com.